This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Coming up later on our show, we'll hear from the director of Mobile in Black and White. It's a film which centers on race relations in America. That film will screen at the Capital City Film Festival, but we're going to hear more about the lineup later from the organizers on our show today. But first, inmates who leave Michigan prisons at the end of their sentences need an array of support services to help them successfully re-enter society. The Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative was created in 2003 to fulfill that goal. The program has done quite well in the years since, but the state is still seeking ways to improve. The Michigan Department of Corrections is asking service providers to help enhance the post-prison experience for those who've served their time. I'm joined today by Russ Marlin. He's a public information officer for the DOC. Welcome to Current State, Russ.
Thank you, Emmanuel. It's great to be here.
So how many inmates are currently in Michigan prisons and how many are released each year?
Right now we have about 43,500 prisoners in our 31 correctional facilities. And it varies year to year, but we release anywhere from 9,000 to 10,000 people a year.
So when these people are released, what are they given? I mean, are they given an ID, money, bus ticket? What is the immediate things that the state provides for them?
Well, as you mentioned, we started planning the prisoner reentry program in 2003 and piloted it in a few urban areas in Michigan from 05 to 07, and then 07 it went statewide. But, you know, I started my career as a parole officer in Detroit in 1992, and we had no reentry program then. We had, no services were afforded to people who left prison. Philosophical approach at the time was, you know, you committed a crime, you were sentenced to prison, you know, get out and do the right thing. I had guys come into my office who had left prison with no ID, no transportation, no safe, stable place to live, no job opportunities. And I knew as a parole officer that was just not a good recipe for success. And so you knew what they were most likely going to do when they left my office, and it wasn't remain crime-free. So the program we have now does address a number of those areas. Identification is certainly one that's important, transportation, employment, housing, and other services as well. So we try to provide the things that there's a gap in as someone who leaves prison and returns home. And, the program was somewhat controversial when we launched it because we were funding services for felons, services that necessarily other citizens would not receive. But the sole focus of the program was to reduce our recidivism rate, to decrease crime in Michigan communities. And you're right, it has been successful in doing just that.
What are some of the biggest challenges for prisoners once they leave?
Well, they have a number of challenges, and it really depends on how long they stay in prison. I think our average prison sentence is just over 5 years now, but if they're away from society for a number of years, they lose those soft skills and how to deal effectively with people in the workplace. They may not have experience navigating the internet or using computers, cell phones, these types of things. But I think the primary problem they face is employment. The employment rate for people who leave prison is very low. It's hovered around 25% for the past several years. So I think they have a stigma about coming out of prison and admitting that fact to potential employers. Limited work history, and it certainly plays an impact on that. But this time around, as you mentioned, we're hosting this request for information on Thursday. And we really want that to focus on employment. We've done a great job of lowering recidivism, addressing other areas, but the employment rate has kind of remained stagnant, and we want to see that improve. If we can get these folks employed, they're going to be doing something productive during the day. It makes them feel better about themselves, and probably most importantly, it will provide them income to fund a number of things that we're already funding, like transportation and housing and identification, those types of things.
You mentioned that the program was launched over 11 years ago and it's been successful, but expand a little bit about its success and how successful it's been.
Well, at the time that we launched the program, our recidivism rate was about 44%, meaning of everyone that we release from prison, 44% of them come back to prison within 3 years. That rate today is 29%. So we've seen a significant reduction in our recidivism rate, which means we're releasing the 9 to 10,000 people from prison, and they're doing a better job of remaining crime-free and being successful in society. And that was the point of the program. That 29% is the lowest in the Midwest, and it's one of the lowest in the nation. So we're very proud of that recidivism rate. And you know, I think as we redesign and improve the program even more, we're hopeful that we can see that 29% rate drop even further.
The program's been successful, but I imagine that there are still resources lacking. What is lacking?
Well, I think primarily it's around the employment. And what we're hoping to get is some ideas from community providers and community service providers, folks that have an expertise in getting hard-to-place populations working. And, you know, the issues that we have is how to fund that, how to structure that. You know, since 2007, we've tried a variety of avenues. We've paid employers to take these folks for a short period of time. We've done tryout employment. We've done other types of prep and getting them ready for employment. And like I said, the employment rate has hovered around 25%, so we haven't seen an increase on that. So we're looking for a way to structure employment services for parolees in a way that gets us to that end goal, which is a higher employment rate. We'd like to see that 25% employment rate go up, you know, 10 to 15 points. We want to see more people leave prison and become employed.
Russ Marlin is the public information officer for the DOC. We're talking with him about the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Program. You said when the program first launched that it was controversial in some ways because we're spending money on people who are prisoners. A lot of people don't feel that prisoners deserve the same services as people, other people in society. And we're talking about employment now, and I think a lot of people would still kind of have that attitude of, well, I can't get a job, and I didn't commit a crime, and I didn't have to go to jail. Talk a little bit about why you think it's important that these people are given a fair chance on the employment field.
Well, you know, when we launched our program, not a lot of states across the country were doing prisoner reentry, so we were one of the first. And it was a bit of a controversial program at first because we were using, you know, state tax dollars to fund areas that, you know, crime-free citizens didn't receive those services. But we did a lot of work educating folks around the state. We did a lot of editorial board visits, and we showed that this is not about, you know, necessarily helping people who were leaving prison just for that sole reason. It was all about reducing crime and making communities safer. And, you know, we knew, we had studied, we had mapped the issues of our population as they left, and we knew there were certain areas, there were certain gaps that caused people to recidivate. If they got out and they didn't have certain services, they would go acquire what they needed, and it wasn't through legitimate means. So, you know, there's a lot of education to the public and to legislators who help fund this program that this program will reduce crime, will make Michigan community safer. And without the experience of other states, that was a difficult sell at first. And now, you know, several years into the program, we've seen our recidivism rate drop. We've seen our prison population. At the time we started this program, we were the fifth largest prison system in the country at 51,500. So we've seen our prison population drop by 8,000, closed several facilities, saved hundreds of millions of dollars, and also achieved our number one goal, which is reducing recidivism.
Governor Snyder's proposed budget for the fiscal years of 2015 and 2016, it calls for just over $2 billion for the DOC, and about $310 million of that would go towards parole, probation, and community programs. Do you know how much of that is earmarked for the prison reentry program?
Well, it's about 20-some million dollars total, but the number that we're putting out to the community to help fund services as people leave is $14 million.
Since the creation of the prisoner reentry program, to what degree have service providers cooperated to form a network to help ex-cons? Is it just individuals acting as entities, or is it kind of a unified team or unified front?
You know, it's been both. And as we set up this program, we didn't want a cookie-cutter program for the entire state. We recognize that there are different issues for returning citizens across the state. When you look at the Ann Arbor area, affordable housing is a big issue down there for our folks. Unemployment is a more significant factor in certain areas. When you get up around the Northern Michigan Traverse City area, transportation is important as people may be living in rural areas and need reliable transportation to a job that's in a more urban setting. So we did not want to say this is how you should do it in the community. We brought in community folks and people that had specialties in transportation and social services and identification and employment and housing, and we tapped their knowledge in crafting the program. And so that's what we want to do again. I think we believe the program has been successful because of that partnership and that collaboration. We've partnered with United Ways and Michigan Works across the state have been a strong partner. Other community corrections programs, social service programs across the state have helped us out as well.
What's the feedback that the state received been like from former prisoners on how they've adjusted to civilian life after kind of going through these programs?
It's been very good. And now I think the prisoner population is pretty much aware of the prisoner reentry program. But, as we started it, it was kind of fascinating to see a key component of the program is these transition teams. So a prisoner is going to return to, the Flint area, let's say, and we bring in service providers from Flint, and they came to the prison. The prisoner came to a conference room, and he sat down, and he saw people from his home community, strangers to him, sat down and started asking him questions like, where are you going to live? How are you going to get around? What kind of work do you have? What kind of experience do you have? And giving the prisoner their card, and you call me when you get out, and I'll help you in this area. I'll help you in this area. And the look of shock that came across these prisoners' faces, they had obviously inflicted harm on society, and for these strangers to drive out to a prison on a Saturday afternoon to talk with a prisoner was very emotional for them. They just couldn't believe that someone would do that. And these people were very clear. They said, I'm here to help you, but I'm here because helping you is going to help my community, and I want to help you transition back to society because that's going to make my community safer. And so it was kind of surprising for prisoners at first, but I think now they're knowledgeable about the program and they see the very big benefits that it provides them.
Yeah, I mean, seeing that alone must just be an incentive to make it work in some ways.
They'd say, this is the first time in my life that someone has shown this much caring for me, and you are not my family members, you're total strangers. And so it was some of them would break down and just start crying. It was very emotional for them.
Explain tomorrow's event a little bit, when and where.
It's at the Capitol Commons Center in Lansing, and it's from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m. We have some folks from our department that will be there. We're going to be listening to ideas and suggestions from community providers. As I said, as corrections professionals, our expertise lies in running safe, secure prisons, supervising people in the community. But social services, employment, transportation, housing, these types of things lie way outside of our area of expertise. And so we want to hear people that do this kind of stuff every day effectively. We want to hear their thoughts, their input, their ideas. We'll take all of that in, and the next step is to create a request for proposal, a bid, for these services in the communities across Michigan, and then allow entities to bid on that.
Russ Marlin is the Public Information Officer for the Michigan Department of Corrections. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you very much.
It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature the Capital Region Community Foundation's Youth Action Community, or YAC. The committee is made up of high school students in the Tri-County area who volunteer and distribute grants to area nonprofits that serve youth. Here to tell us more is Ashley Golker, the Youth Action Committee Advisor for the Capital Region Community Foundation, and joining her is Sammy Ward, this year's YAC President and Senior at Bath High School. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Ashley, tell me a little bit about how this program works.
Sure. So I'm the YAC advisor, as you mentioned, and we basically recruit high schoolers from the Tri-County area, and we try to have representation from as many high schools as we can, and we get together on a monthly basis. We meet at the Armory in Lansing, and we learn about philanthropy, grant making, and the youth also serve in the community. So we do about once a month, we do a service project, and then we have two different granting cycles throughout the year. So the youth are involved throughout the entire process, and it's really a youth empowerment model. So the youth get to make decisions about how they want the group to look, and what they want to do, where they want to serve, and ultimately they also make the decisions around our granting as well.
That's probably a power that high school students don't get very often to decide
exactly
where money goes.
Yes.
Sammy, how did you find out about the Youth Action Committee?
There was actually an announcement through our school announcements, you know, end of the day stuff. And when you hear Youth Action Committee, especially like as a high school student, you're like, yeah, that's a thing. So a friend of mine and I didn't really know what it was, but we were interested in it. You know, it sounded nice. So we looked into it more. You know, there's the website that you go into, and it sounded really great. You know, the volunteer opportunities, getting involved in like the backside of grant making was really interesting. So we went to a few meetings and we fell in love with it. It was really cool.
Sammy, explain how the issues that the groups prioritize with the funds, how does that work?
Sure. So we have a needs assessment that we put out every 3 years, and it is just a survey that we give to high school students throughout the Tri-County area. We give it, you know, to our members who then distribute it to high school students, and they just tell us what they think are the major problems that are facing youth today. Our past one, we are due for a new one soon, but our past one found that bullying, self-esteem, and stress related to college and career pressure were the three top needs that need to be addressed. So when we're looking at grants, we make sure we prioritize those projects that focus on bullying, self-esteem, or career pressure.
Ashley, how does the awarding process work? You said you have two grant cycles. So when did those take place, and kind of how do you guys choose and break down?
Sure, yeah. So in the fall, you know, we basically meet alongside the academic year. So in the fall, we start with a smaller granting cycle, generally about $5,000 to elementary school classrooms. So teachers can apply for grants with their classroom. For those are grants of up to $500 each. And we keep it pretty broad in terms of what they can apply for, and that granting cycle is sort of an introduction for the youth on the YAC committee, so they can sort of get their feet wet and figure out what's all this about. We can teach them about the grant making process with a smaller granting cycle, about $5,000, and then in January we introduce a request for proposals for a larger granting cycle for youth-serving nonprofits throughout the Tri-County area. So we serve Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties, and any nonprofit can apply for funds of up to $2,500 each. So that sort of is the second round of granting that we do. And we encourage youth participation in both of those mm-hmm. Granting cycles. So ideally, we want youth, even that are not in the YAC, to be exposed to grant writing and what does it mean to sort of meet community needs and apply for funding, you know. So that's the hope. And so then the second round in January, we grant out about $45,000 a year. So in total, about $50,000, give or take. So Yeah.
Yeah. What are some examples of some of the projects that you guys have awarded funds to, Sammy?
Recently, we've done things like we actually gave to WKAR for a for an anti-bullying video ad that's been being developed, which was great because it obviously met our needs. We did a shared pregnancy women's center grant to provide resources for materials for teen moms. We get a few of those every year, which is also kind of on our needs assessment. We do things for tech kind of programs. There's like an iTech that helps kids with robotics and that, you know, gets like math into programs. And then we did Eastside Community Action Agency to help fund after school programs for teens. So we really tried to, you know, have broad programs that we grant money to that really is effective in helping teens.
You also volunteer at events and places where you fund, correct?
Tell
me about that.
Yeah. So along with, you know, giving out money, we like to give out our time too. And we volunteer, we try to, you know, do places that we grant out to as well, but also just other things. We do the State Special Olympics every year, which is always really rewarding. We do soup kitchens and Salvation Army, like toy distribution, food banks. And actually, on Sunday, we're doing a beautification project for the Village Summit, which is in the Fabulous Acres neighborhood. So we do a lot of stuff. You know, we try to get around and just help out the community in any way we can.
Ashley, how do you go about trying to get the word out to students? Sammy said she heard it in an announcement. Are you making a lot of announcements at different schools?
Right. So it's kind of difficult because we serve a pretty broad geographical region. There are 86 yaks across the state, actually, so we are one of those. So each yak looks a little bit different, and so ours tends to serve a bit of a broader geographical region than some of the others. So it can be challenging to reach every single high school and try to find representation from all of them. It's hard for me to be in multiple places all the time, but one of the best ways is through word of mouth from our current members. So we ask members to think about, what do we want our yak to look like? We want it to reflect the diversity of our community, right? So we try to engage people from all backgrounds, and that you don't have to be on the honor roll to be in yak. You know, you have to want to serve your community. So we do word of mouth. We try to get in contact with the schools, with administration, to put out announcements, like what worked with Sammy, mm-hmm. and also with our service projects as well. So if we're serving at youth serving agencies, a lot of times they have youth that might be interested in joining YAC, and we try to get youth into our program when they're freshmen or sophomores, ideally, because then they have a couple years where they can develop and then sort of move into more of a leadership position as they progress through high school. And then, you know, by the time they're a senior, they're helping freshmen and sophomores throughout the process, so that we constantly have a good mix of people.
Sammy, you're a senior this year. What are your plans? And I guess, what will you take with you from your experience working with YAC?
So I've been in YAC 3 years, and I'm going to Michigan State University next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But YAC has really just opened up like the world of nonprofits and volunteering for me. It's given me some great connections, and next year, obviously, there's lots of volunteer opportunities at MSU, and I look forward into not only, you know, keeping my toes in the YAC community, but also expanding and getting in other volunteer opportunities.
Sammy Ward is this year's YAC president and a senior at Bath High School. Ashley Golker is a Youth Action Committee advisor for the Capital Region Community Foundation. Thank you guys both for joining us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We could always use more information, and we could always use more nominations. And we know that there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out. Tweet a suggestion at KAR Current State or send an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. The Capital City Film Festival starts tomorrow, Thursday, and runs through the weekend at a number of locations around Lansing. Current State's Melissa Benmark has more on one of the films at the festival, and she joins us now.
Hey, Emmanuel. On Saturday, a film about race relations in America will air at LCC's Dart Auditorium, and it's called Mobile in Black and White. I spoke with the creator, Robert Gray, about the film. He's on staff at the University of South Alabama, but his connection to Michigan is that he spent some time in graduate school here at MSU. And he says that, you know, some people will make short films to promote a bigger film. Well, this actually started out as four shorter segments broken up by discussions, but he decided to make a feature-length film too, hoping in some ways to maybe bring people back to the shorter segment and discussion approach.
When you do it in a one-off situation like that, after a few days, you kind of get changed back into who you were before you started. But with the segment conversation version, I think if people come and watch it and talk about it and sort of, as Sonia Sanchez says in the film, develop new eyes, then you come back the next week after using those new eyes for a week, and you think some more, and you learn some more, and you talk some more, and then you come back the next week, then people actually start to transform their consciousness and see the world differently. And if enough people can start seeing the world differently, then they can start sharing those experiences and starting holding policymakers and just the people around them more accountable for the things that, you know, are going on. Because I think in a lot of ways what race relations has become in this supposedly post-racial world, it's an awareness issue. It's not a reality issue, because it's not individuals going around oppressing people or being mean to people or calling people names. It's something that's sort of built into the structural processes of our culture, and most people, especially those in the dominant group, are totally oblivious to how those processes are affecting people's lives, because it's not affecting their lives. And so I think if we can get more people in the dominant culture particularly, but throughout the society, to be more aware and to be more thoughtful about the issue, then I think change can happen. And, you know, I don't know how big of a dent one film project can do, but, I mean, just the testimonials I've gotten from people here in Mobile who have seen it, and from the festivals we've already been to, it seems to be doing something.
It's interesting because sometimes people will make a short film or a trailer in order to bring attention to the longer film, but I get the impression hearing you talk that really, if you had your druthers, that the feature-length film would draw attention to the segments, the 40-minute segments, and that people would maybe experience this in the original form that you intended.
I think so, yeah. I'm becoming more and more convinced that the best entree into the project is through the feature, because that's the one that's easiest to stumble upon, especially outside of Mobile, and we don't have any budget to promote this thing, and so it's not like we can blitzkrieg the country with publicity. But, you know, if people in Lansing come to see the feature film, and that the one of the last things in the film is a slide of text that comes up that says, you know, the purpose of this is to start conversations, and if you'd like to start a conversation, go to the website and get more information, and, you know, hopefully people will do that, you know, that they'll want to get the segments. I've had people out of nowhere, like in Vermont, email me a couple, like last week, and wanted access to the segments because they wanted to start a conversation in their community, and I don't know how they heard about it, but, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think the feature can do, because starting a conversation takes some effort and it takes, you know, some organization, and so somebody has to sort of been sold on that concept before they can start the conversation.
I was reading on your website some of the materials related to the conversation, and that, you know, that you'd like people to engage in as a result of this film. And I was struck by, is in one of the segments it says, consensus is not the goal. And so many of us see consensus as, well, of course we all want to be on the same page. Talk about why did you say that? Why do you believe that?
You know, I don't think that consensus is a realistic expectation. And because people come from such different places and have such different perspectives on issues. And usually if you reach consensus, that means that somebody is converted or moved, sometimes unwantingly, to a position that's foreign to them. And what's, I think, more important is to get people to respect the differences of opinion and understand why those differences exist. You know, the way I'm going to look at this issue, no matter how open-minded I become or how wise or educated I become about the issue, there's no way that I can really understand what it's like to see the world through the eyes of a 17-year-old poor African-American male or female or a person of any age. And so for me to expect them to think like I do and to understand the world like I do from my middle-class white male perspective, that's just unrealistic. And so, but when I can learn from them how they see the world as much as I'm capable of doing and respect them and think that their view is valid, then that's not consensus, but I think it's in some ways better than consensus. And hopefully they can kind of see my way and sort of understand why I think the way that I do, and we can avoid sort of placing value judgments on what we perceive as wrong about somebody else's perspective, when it's just their perspective is based on a different set of data and that their interpretation is just as valid as ours is.
Different things motivate people to start the conversation about racism. You know, anger, shame. The thing is that this is not usually a conversation that we have when we feel like everything is all right. What motivated you personally to make a film meant to open that conversation up, which is a lot of the time a hard conversation?
Well, I grew up in Alabama, in a small town in central Alabama, and I had my concept of what racism was and thought that was a bad thing, but I didn't really understand the whole problem because I was so part of that milieu. A lot of it was invisible to me. And then I went to the University of Alabama and got my bachelor's and master's degree, and then I went to Michigan State and was working on a doctoral degree. And moving from the Deep South to the Midwest was a pretty interesting experience for me because race relations were different on the surface, but they weren't really that different underneath. And it sort of let me gain a critical perspective of both sides. I could see the Midwest situation with a critical lens that really wasn't available to people in the Midwest. And also by situating myself in that and sort of becoming a part of that culture, I could look back at the one I came from and kind of see it through a different lens as well. And just some of the things I studied up there, Peggy McIntosh is in the film, and reading her article that made her famous about white privilege really kind of opened my eyes in profound ways. And it just made me much more interested in issues of race and racism. And so I started incorporating that into my studies and into my teaching. And then I moved back to Alabama and tried to make that one of my... It was always more about trying to build awareness. You know, I think it's totally unfruitful to go around accusing somebody of being a racist. And I think it's really important when you talk about race to very carefully avoid making people feel like you're implying that they're a racist or that you think they should be guilty or anything like that, because not that many of us today are openly guilty about the situation. You know, there aren't that many people that identify as racist, and even the ones that most people would identify, you know, or that most other people would say that person's a racist, that person would deny it. And I think they would honestly deny it. I think very few people think of themselves as racist, whether they are or not. I think everybody, to some extent, is a racist. But it's not something that we need to go around pointing fingers about because it's not fruitful. We need to just start thinking about how the situation is different than we think it is and how it's the institutional and structural levels of racism that really affect people's lives. And most of us aren't aware of that. And if we can become aware of that, And once we're aware of that, if we choose not to do anything about it, then maybe there's a racism there, but I don't really want to go there.
There are people who feel that talking about racism just makes it worse. I don't know how many times in the last couple years in the media there's, oh, so-and-so's playing the race card. How do you respond to that?
Usually when you hear somebody say talking about race makes it worse, that's usually coming from a white perspective. And one of the best retorts that I've heard is, it makes it worse for you. It doesn't make it worse for people of color. Most people think it's not a problem. And when you talk about it, it becomes a problem. And the reality is that it's not a problem for most white people, because they're not at the lower end of that dynamic. You know, one of the big things about white privilege is that I, as a middle-class white person, can go through my entire life without ever thinking about race, and it won't affect my life whatsoever. People of color don't have that privilege. They have to think about it almost every minute of every day of their life. And so when race is inserted into my consciousness as a white person, then that seems that it makes it worse, because it makes me angry that I have to think about this. And it makes my friends angry because they're forced to think about this. It doesn't make it worse for the people that it's already bad for. And so that's one thing. There are people in certain communities, and Mobile, I understand, can sometimes be one of those communities, that people of color aren't always comfortable about talking about race because they fear a backlash can happen to them. When we first started trying to pilot the community conversation process, there was a prominent African-American group in town that a member of the committee that was sort of helping advise on the film really wanted to get them. He was a member of that other group, and he was trying to get them to have a conversation, and there was just a lot of resistance in the group to do it, because they'd fought so long to make the gains they had, and they were afraid that if people heard they were causing trouble and looking into something like that, that there would be a backlash and that they would lose some of those gains. Just the fact that there were enough people felt strongly enough about that they refused to take part in this project, to me, kind of spoke volumes. And I've heard sort of similar stories in other places. It's not, I don't think, limited to Mobile.
That something about that did not make them feel like they were safe to engage in that.
Right, that there would be a backlash about, so you're not happy about the situation. Well, let me show you. In other communities where we've had the film, I've heard similar sentiments. So it is a challenge.
Well, Robert Gray, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with your film, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the Capital City Film Festival.
Well, thank you.
We just heard from Robert Gray, the director of Mobile in Black and White. That film is part of the 4th Annual Capital City Film Festival, which showcases 4 days of films and music. We have the director, Dominic Cochran, and festival coordinator, Payal Ravani. They're in studio to discuss this year's offerings. So, Dom, let's start with opening night. You're kicking off the festival. Not opening night. One of the films featured in this year's festival is called Alive Inside. It's centered around dementia and the healthcare system. What about this film made you decide that you wanted to feature it?
Well, one of the interesting quotes I read in a review of the film says, it's impossible to not take this film personally. And one of the lines in the trailer is that this is a conversation that we all need to have. Aging is unavoidable. There's 5 million Alzheimer's patients in this country, and the number is probably going to double in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's a really important issue. And I don't want to paint a picture that this film is like one of those typical issue films, because it's actually also one of the most uplifting films I've seen in the past few years. So it's one of the few documentaries that presents an issue and also actually has a way to move forward and a way for all of us to get involved and to help. So it's a film that touched me like I haven't been touched in a while by a movie. So it was great. So that's one of the films we're telling people, if you can only see one film, that should probably be it, because it's just really a beautiful movie.
And when is that screening again?
That's Thursday night at 7:15 at the Lansing Center.
Payal, what other documentaries will be featured this year?
We will have quite a few documentaries this year that we're very excited about. We're going to be featuring Project Ice, which is a film that was released just a few weeks ago. It's about Great Lakes and ice in all of its beautiful forms. So it does definitely touch on the topic of climate change and the issue that, you know, we're all facing right now with the Great Lakes and climate change. It's a very beautiful film as well. So
lots of different things from the environment to healthcare. You guys also have 5 short blocks this year, blocks of short films featuring a wide range of topics. And one of them is the American Film Institute's Women Directors Showcase. Why do you think it's important to have this feature of female directors and their films in the festival, Payal?
Well, female film directors make up less than 10% of all filmmakers. And so we definitely hone in on that and want to feature the work that is out there that is very well done, that doesn't necessarily get attention at other festivals or in other theater circuits and whatnot. And so the American Film Institute Shorts Block is something we started doing a few years ago, and we make sure to do it every year because this is a free workshop that the American Film Institute offers to aspiring female directors. And so this is work that has been produced during that workshop, and they shop it out to festivals after, so we're always very excited to showcase that. And as for the other 5 Shorts Blocks, our program director, Jason Gabriel, stands by his statement that he said a few months ago when he was screening all these films, and that the short films are extremely high quality this year during our festival. So,
Dom, are there any in particular shorts that you're interested in seeing or would recommend?
Well, in addition to the 5 full shorts blocks that we have, I mean, it was like Payal said, I mean, we had so many this year, it was hard to call the field. In addition to those, we have some local shorts that are playing in front of the features too. So if you think of all the films that make up the short blocks, plus almost every feature has a short film with it, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of films. I would say some of the local ones we have, actually, Before Alive Inside, we have Shotgun Wedding, directed by Michael McCallum. We have a short film about the Scottville Clown Band, which is a Michigan institution. They've been around for like 100 years, and it's this group of ragtag guys that just do like all these small town parades in Michigan. But it's not a documentary about them. It's actually a narrative film, and it kind of has a lot of twists and turns. It just features them. So, and that plays. Friday night
before one of our world premieres.
Yeah, we have a world premiere feature called You Are a Loved One.
Yeah, tell me about the plot of that film a little bit.
Well, it's actually I haven't seen the film. I'm sorry. We should have had our program director with us. But the filmmakers from that film are actually joining us from Los Angeles, and the director and writer is Michigan native. Chris Bouffard, or actually he's the star, and so they're really excited to be a part of the festival and to come back home, and we're really glad that they chose our festival for the world premiere. That's a unique opportunity.
Right. The film is a narrative, so it's sort of a dark romantic comedy about this person coming off of pharmaceutical drugs that he had been addicted to, falling in love and whatnot. So it's a dark romantic comedy. But with a dark tone.
You mentioned there Michigan native for the world premiere. It seems like you're featuring a lot of local talent in this festival. Why is it important for you guys to feature that local talent?
We love doing that. We love featuring our Michigan artists, Michigan made, Michigan produced filmmakers and films. And it's something that fluctuates from year to year based on submissions and what films are available and in the works. And this year we happen to have a very strong contingent of Michigan-made films. And so we know it's important to highlight film that's made here in Michigan, filmmakers that are from here. Michigan has a very robust film industry, and so we love showcasing that to the community.
This film festival is also unique because of the Fortnite showcase that you guys do, the competition each year. You have professional, amateur filmmakers, student filmmakers make a 10-minute feature over the course of just 14 days. You had 32 teens participate this year. How has that part of the festival grown or changed over the past 3 years, Dom?
Well, that's my personal favorite thing that we do. I'm a filmmaker myself. I'm a cinematographer. So I've participated in these film contests for like 15 years. And the reason why we did 2 weeks as opposed to like some of these are like 24 hours or 48 hours or 1 week, we like the people to end up with a film that they can actually, it can stand on its own. You know, if you make a movie in 2 days, you always end up with a movie that you have to give the disclaimer. Sorry, I had to make this, in two days. But please watch it. So the quality of these films is actually very surprising. This year, it's the strongest of all. It has, like you said, it's definitely grown. There's more teams than ever this year, and the quality is really good. So we're excited to showcase those. We're going to play the top 15 of the 32 entries on Sunday at 11 a.m. at the Lansing Public Media Center. And that's where we give away the prizes, too. So
it's so awesome to see these filmmakers so excited about this contest. You know, even beyond the cash prize that's attached to it, it's a really awesome opportunity for them to make a film that they can be proud of and use elsewhere, maybe in other film festivals. And we of the 32 teams this year, several of them are not returning. So they're newly engaged filmmakers in the area and all over Michigan. So.
And speaking with Dominic Cochran and Payal Ravani, both organizers for the Capital City Film Festival. Payal, this year you have children's films are also going to be featured. The feature film for that showcase is Miyazaki's Totoro, as well as other shorts. Why did you decide to incorporate youth films into the festival?
Well, we had a lot of feedback, actually, from folks who are like, we love your festival, but, you know, there's nothing here for my children. While that is definitely not a focus of our festival, it is something we wanted to incorporate to make sure that, you know, families felt comfortable coming to this festival and had something there for them. And so we felt it would be fun to do a throwback. We actually have three really great short films that will screen before Totoro. One is a silent film with child actors, and then one is a French film, and then one is an animated film about a family of light bulbs, which is so adorable. So we'll be doing that on Saturday at 2 p.m. at Dart Auditorium on LCC's campus. I think it's fun for kids to be in that big theater.
I want to go see Totoro. So.
the silent film is called Sheriff Mustache Saves Pickle Town. So.
Arguably the best title
Sounds like my kind of film.
And that
day.
Is actually a first-time filmmaker's film. So.
Awesome. Music, once again, is going to play a major role in this festival. The music lineup has doubled in size this year, and you have so many great acts. Like I was saying, I don't know what to go see. But I'd like to feature a few now. The artist Dessa is a rapper, singer, spoken word artist, and she's part of the Minneapolis hip-hop collective Doomtree. And this is a clip of her song, The Skeleton Key.
I haven't met a locked door yet that I couldn't beat. On a chain around my neck, I keep my skeleton key. Don't waste your worry on me. I always find what I need. Come and go as I please. I've got my skeleton key. Don't waste your worry on me.
Dessa and her song, The Skeleton Key. She'll be playing at The Loft on Friday. You guys, what are some of the other major music acts that are going to be part of this year's festival pile?
We have Break Science coming in tomorrow. They're an electronic artist duo. They're on Pretty Lights label, so they're going to definitely be a fun one to kick off the festival. We're very excited for Dessa, of course. We haven't had a lot of hip-hop acts in the past, so we're definitely excited to have one of those showcased this year. Dan Kroll will be coming through on the last night on Sunday at The Loft. He just released his first album. I believe it dropped last week in the United States. He is a British singer-songwriter. He's been making his rounds, for sure. He's definitely on the verge of blowing up, so catch him at The Loft while you can.
It should be a good show. This year, you guys are also incorporating some new venues into the event. What are some of the new places, and where will most of the films be shown and music acts?
Yeah, so we part of the mission of the festival is to kind of repurpose some of these urban venues and vacant buildings and transform them into beautiful places to see movies. So one of the places that we're doing that this year is actually the former Mustang Bar in Old Town. And it's like the last vacant building in Old Town. You know, obviously Old Town's
a vacant building in Old Town.
I know, and it's right there on Turner Street. So it is interesting that that's like the one last vacant spot in this, you know, booming area. But it's just a bare building with these really cool brick walls. So we're going to do some really cool lighting and put a movie screen in there. So we're really excited about that being a new venue. But in addition to that, the other film venues are Dart Auditorium and LCC's campus and the Lansing Public Media Center in the former Michigan National Guard Armory in South Washington. So that's a really cool venue, too. And, of course, the Lansing Center is where we'll have opening night and closing night this year.
So films and music all over the city.
And the second venue we added for music this year is Max Bar, so it'll be a little bit farther down on Michigan Avenue, but
still in the area.
Closer to campus.
Yeah. The Capital City Film Festival starts Thursday and runs through Sunday. Festival organizers Payal Ravani and Dominic Cochran, thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And to take us out, we have music from one of the festival acts. This is a track from Dan Kroll. It's called From Nowhere. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow in Current State, we'll learn more about our new center to help Michigan food processors develop new products. Also, we'll explore the MSU College of Music's 10-day festival, Latin is America. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.